Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome. Today, we have a very special guest, Dr. Robert Lloyd. He's going to be with us on our Permaculture Central episode about aquatic systems, ponds, and constructed wetlands. He's a microbiologist with over 30 years' experience in these aquatic systems, and is very exciting. And we have a friend online also, Sherry Minnelli, who introduced me to him. And so welcome, Dr. Lloyd. How are you today? Oh, I think just a minute. Are you there?
Yes, I am. I'm
very
good. How are you?
Welcome. Sorry about the little delay there. So I know I introduced you as Dr. Lloyd, but I think you go by Bob. Is that correct?
That's the best name for me. I don't consider myself a doctor.
You don't? Well, no. I know you are.
There was a lot of work involved, but I'm having much more fun out in the world and working with permaculture and stuff. So that's what I enjoy doing, and a doctorate is less important in that environment, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you said that, having fun, because if on my shows, that's what we talk about, permaculture fun. And I kind of coined that term, I think. I actually own the domain name, permaculturefun.com. And that's why permaculture for me is so much fun. Now, it's a serious topic, and there's a lot of interesting things in there that can get quite technical. And I know you're technical, but we try to make it easier for people. So, you know, with your experience, and I know you have a business helping people to establish ponds and wetlands within their properties and maintain those, it's very important because not everyone has that scientific background to do it. And so we're all leaders. We just have different talents and different piece of the puzzle that we manage. So anyway, thank you for being here today. And, you know, I'm excited to hear about what you do and tell us how you kind of got started and interested in water.
I've always enjoyed water, the sound of water. I had friends that had aquariums. I had aquariums. And in my PhD work as a microbiologist, I actually used certain chemicals to deliberately mutagenize bacteria to obtain strains that were deficient in certain biochemical pathways so we could try to elucidate the pathway. Some of the chemicals that I used to deliberately mutagenize bacteria, you can walk into a pet store and buy over the counter to dump in an outside source of water that animals, birds, cats, dogs, squirrels, beneficial insects, bees are drinking from these outside sources of water from ponds and things. And I was just appalled at the type of chemicals that you could just put in them. So I started a small business that focused on maintaining ponds by natural means, by trying to set up ecosystems that were long-term and stable, and adding small aquatic herbivores to eat algae instead of putting in algicides and things like that. So the longer I did it, the more fun I had doing it, and it's enjoyable for me to be outside and to actually be benefiting in a very small way. The animals that drink from these outside sources of water, and ponds are a wonderful addition to a permaculture environment. They provide water, for one thing. Bees, for example, they have determined that a large honeybee hive can drink up to 10 gallons of water a day in the summertime. because what they're doing is they take it back and they put it around the entrance of their hive, and then other bees fan that with their wings, and it causes it to evaporate, and in evaporating it cools the entire hive, kind of like a swamp cooler, if you know what a swamp cooler is.
Right.
And so the result of that is that any chemicals in the water are concentrated right at the entrance of a beehive, 100, 1,000, potentially, depending on the age of the hive, you know, hundreds of thousands of times. And I'm sure that the chemical companies have tested those kinds of concentrations on honeybees. The big chemical companies do such a I don't know how much to be tongue in cheek.
Well, I get it. I know what you're saying. They do the minimal amount of research just to get the product on the market, and he's saying, look at here's the bees, which are so critical to our food sources. And we have colony collapses and all those things. And the bees are using 10 gallons of water a day to cool their hive. Have these companies done research to show that these algicides and the different chemicals being put in the ponds are safe for the bees and our food source and the honey and all this stuff? Of course they haven't. Of course they haven't.
Well, so, and the fact that the water is evaporating and concentrating those chemicals is another huge point with the beehives. So
exactly, over time, yes, absolutely.
So I got interested in the permaculture idea. I laugh. I say I've been doing permaculture all my life. I just didn't know what it was called. But I'd gotten interested in the permaculture community here in San Diego, and it's a wonderful, wonderful community and friendly and outgoing and trying to help everybody set up systems that are sustainable. The idea of a constructed wetland or a pond where you provide habitat for the insects, beneficial insects and animals in your permaculture area is important, in my opinion, a very important thing to do. And down here in San Diego, there's a lot of concern about water use. And the thing that I'm sure that most people aren't aware of is that a pond that's not leaking and only losing water from evaporation or from the transpiration of the plants actually uses very little water, and in many cases uses less water than a xeriscape set up in the same area. And especially with xeriscape, even though the plants in long term are drought resistant, the first couple of years you do need to water them a lot. So a pond can be a wonderful low water use addition to your permaculture environment.
Wonderful. So in case some people don't know what xeriscape is, so these are these very low water landscapes, and they're supposed to save water, and they're fire resistant, and it's a one way of gardening. But so with these pond installations, you're actually saving water, and you might even get more productive ecosystem out of it, because there's the whole living environment within the water, but also now you can attract beneficial insects and other creatures like frogs, and it's quite a environment that you're creating with these ponds.
Yep. There dragonflies. There's an interesting website looking for backyard scientists to try to help them identify dragonfly migratory pathways. Some dragonflies stay in the same locality their entire life, and other dragonflies migrate. I've got all sorts of different kinds of dragonflies. I've got actually three of the different migratory dragonflies. They lay their eggs, and the larvae hatch in the water, and it's a small aquatic organism for, in many cases, a year, and then they crawl out and hatch into a dragonfly. So it's a marvelous ecosystem, and we've lost so much of our freshwater marsh habitat in California. We've destroyed, by building on it, draining it, and developing it and building on it, we've destroyed something on the order of 90% of our freshwater marshes.
Wow. So what can we do to help restore the balance, to come back and repair that damage done?
Well, that's a very good question, because there's so many levels to it. Many of the city governments who are approached by developers who say, "Oh, we need to build here, but what we'll do is we'll develop a new marsh over here off to where it's not as feasible to develop on, and so we'll replace one marsh with another." And this is something like allowing developers to bulldoze an old growth redwood forest and say, "We'll plant a couple of seedlings over here and duplicate it." There's nothing close to being able to duplicate an old growth marsh. We don't understand the complex interactions, and yet we allow developers to just build on them and claim that they're going to repair them or replace them somewhere else. I understand the wonderful work that the organizations, various organizations that are concerned about marsh and habitat loss and the pressure on them to say, "Well, we lose an acre here, but we'll gain 3 acres over there." But we need to stop losing our old growth marshes. And the ability to generate some type of habitat for all these animals that have lost their habitat by people developing or putting a marsh or a pond in their backyard is one critical thing to do. And writing your city legislatures, telling them, you know, don't allow the development of any more marshes. There's a lot of things that we can do, and part of it is staying informed about the issues.
Sherry has a question. Sherry, if you'd like to come online and ask your question about the backyard pond.
Hi there, Bob.
Hi,
I'd
Sherry.
I'd like to know, with the ponds, you know, in California, so many people have the smallest backyards. What would you recommend as far as the width and length of the smallest pond that somebody could do and still have a benefit for the environment?
That also is a wonderful question. The issue with most ponds is not really the length or the width, it's the depth. And in many cities, the building codes request a building permit if you dig it over 2 feet deep. But it really does need to be over 2 feet deep. If it's too shallow, the water heats up too much in the sun. I've got a wonderful pond in Los Angeles where it was originally 2 feet deep, and I talked the owner into digging it deeper, and it's only 3 feet wide and maybe 5 feet long, and he has so many goldfish in it that it's just mind-boggling. And the dragonflies come and hang out by the sides, and she's got a little creek running down and into it. But the depth of the pond, in my opinion, is one of the most critical things, because the deeper it is, it provides ground effect cooling, and so it doesn't get as hot in the summertime. It also provides hiding space for the, if you do have fish or goldfish or koi. If it's too shallow, the numerous raccoons that inhabit California, and I'm sure the rest of the country, they really do like sushi. And the fish are really good at staying away from them because they've been doing this a long time, if they have a place to go. So the deeper the pond, the better. And then width and breadth-wise, which was your question, it does not really need to be it doesn't need to be anywhere close to 10 feet by 10 feet or something like that, because it's you can have a wonderful plant grouping and a little water feature in a very small place.
Well, that's very interesting. So with the ponds that are deeper than 2 feet, you have to have a permit. Are these, do you put the pond liners in there, or are they natural ponds? Or both, I guess.
Well, I like pond liners because concrete, if you decide to change it or do anything else with it, is problematic. Yeah, it's quite an ordeal to remove a lot of concrete or to change a concrete structure. So I'm less enthusiastic about concrete, although there are many builders and people that do wonderful concrete ponds. I'm associated with somebody up in Los Angeles, environmental sculpturing, and they do ponds that look very nice, all out of concrete. I'm not a huge fan. Of course, I'm biased here in California because we've had such a long dry spell that the clay bottom ponds just lose so much water. It's virtually impossible to keep them full unless you've got a dedicated well and pumping into them. I know one system like that where they've got a set of solar arrays to power the pump, so they're not really using oil to maintain the water level, but it still requires a lot of water
A permaculture perspective, it might be better from a permaculture perspective to not have, you know, to have like a pond liner in your design in California because of the evaporation and the lack of natural water sources feeding. Like, to take water out of the aquifer to put into a pond doesn't really make sense.
Well, it's sort of, folks, I've thought about this a lot, actually, and I don't have a good answer, and I don't think it's entirely bad, because the water that soaks out kind of permeates back down and ends up, you're basically cycling the water. So it's just, though, it's laborious, and I prefer for myself and the ponds that I work on, I prefer them to be lined so that you don't have that loss of water. Also, you know, that's a good point. I think I've got comment on our water, our aquifer here in California, we truly don't know what's in it. People drill wells and they test maybe five things out of the well water and say it's fine, and none of those five things are a significant impact to a human. If you've got Roundup breakdown products or you've got other herbicide or pesticide breakdown products in the water, they don't even know what those breakdown products are, and if you don't know what they are, you can't test for them. And even if you didn't know what they are, it costs thousands of dollars to run those kinds of tests, to test specific chemicals in well water. So there's that issue as well.
Yeah. Well, I think hopefully everyone on the line is aware that chemicals, added chemicals, are not natural. I mean, we in permaculture, it's a design science. We try to look at nature and to mimic the patterns in nature and how it's done. So when you're creating these water systems within your design, we try to do it the natural way. And that's what I love about your business, is that you do it the natural way, and you put in plant systems and, you know, different features. I mean, I don't know exactly the science behind it, but you're doing it the natural way, which is awesome. I have a question here from California Living. It says, do you incorporate fountains within the pond for a visual point of view and to aerate the water? What about aeration of the water?
Aeration of water is something that a lot of people believe in more strongly than is necessary. In most cases, a fountain generates a more of a cooling effect for the pond than an aeration. The spray of water out of the fountain as it evaporates cools the water, and then when it falls back into the pond, it sinks to the bottom, and you can have a more shallow pond if you've got a fountain, because the fountain is keeping it cooler. If the water temperature does go up, that causes a loss of oxygen too. Oxygen is much less soluble in as the water temperature goes up. So there's a combination there. So I don't want to say you don't need a fountain for oxygenation at all, because it's intricately related to the water temperature. But my feeling is that the fountains are more effective at keeping the water temperature down than just the oxygenation. The thing that you were saying about the plants, that's what we try to do with our establishing ecosystems, stable long-term ecosystems, with a combination of plants and small aquatic animals, in many cases relatives of a shrimp, to maintain the water quality without putting in algicides and water conditioners and all the other stuff that you can buy at a pet store.
So when establishing a new pond with a pond liner, how quickly can you, I'm sure you'd have to wait before you introduce fish, let's say. You'd put the plants in before you'd put fish. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, and there's what's known as new tank syndrome, where when you put the water in the tank, in a fish tank, in the same as a pond, and then you add the fish waste is not broken down completely, and so builds up to a toxic level very quickly, and the fish suffer and in many cases die because the microbial flora environment has not been able to establish. So when we're doing a new pond, we, as you said, try to set up the plants and develop the ecosystem before we put in the fish.
Now, can these ponds be self-sustaining, meaning once they're established that the fish that are introduced, that they can actually live off of the plants, the algae, the perhaps mosquitoes that come to the pond, rather than having to feed them fish food from a store?
To some extent. Many fish are omnivores, and it's like getting McDonald's every day for lunch. You know, sometimes you want something like a big juicy peach or a nice, you know,
right,
fresh zucchini or something. So the plants, the environment provides them an area to play, to have fun themselves. Fish love rooting around. I should say, particularly goldfish and koi are carp relatives, and they're bottom feeders, and they just love rooting around in stuff and exploring new areas of the bottom. And so the addition of plants and things like that provide little niches areas for them to root around in and have a lot of fun, and then provide some nutrition that they might not get from prepared food. And the fish in the ponds I maintain seem to be pretty happy.
But are they fed supplements? Meaning, like, can they eventually just be a pond growing in nature as if they would in nature, or is it impossible to create a system like that?
In most cases, it's too small. Most backyard ponds are too small to have completely self-sustaining ecosystem like you're talking about. I mean, if you have a larger lake or something, you know, that is easy to set up. But what I would envision is in somebody's backyard or front yard is a little small to have it
sure.
be completely self-sustaining. The main thing with the plants and stuff is that they're taking the nutrients, the fish waste out of the water too, and producing plant growth. So instead of toxins building up in the water, you get more and more plants, and you can cut them out, and you in essence remove all the fish nutrients that would have ultimately poison the fish. You remove them as plant, and you can compost them, and you can do anything you want with those plants.
All right. You mentioned a word that I want to come back to, water composting, but let's not talk about that yet, because there's a question from Sherry. Sherry, let's come online and ask your question about the sprays, organic.
Yeah, I have heard that there are some sprays that, even though they're organic, will still hurt soil life. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, if we use, you know, are there any organic sprays that we might use in our yard if we're trying to go organic that might not be good around the ponds or might seep into the ponds and hurt that kind of life?
Right. There are several. My belief is that one of the most toxic is neem oil. It will kill salmon at concentrations of 0.45 parts per million. So neem oil is extremely toxic to a lot of things, and we don't really have it. It's been sold as a green pesticide, but remember that anything that ends in CIDE, fungicide, pesticide, herbicide, is designed to kill things. And with neem oil, they have not, it's relatively new, and they have not fully investigated all the different biological properties of it. And it's also one of these compounds. Many plants produce compounds that are called phototoxins. They're more toxic in the presence of light, and which you can imagine from a plant's point of view is a good thing. You're out growing in sunlight, and the grasshoppers or the herbivorous insects that are going to be feeding on you are mostly exposed to the sunlight too. So if you can produce a toxin that uses the efficiency of sunlight to be more toxic, that's a good thing. And neem oil is a plant product, and there's evidence, again, there's fairly minimal good analysis of a lot of pesticides. We don't know what they break down to. We don't know a lot of stuff about them. But there's some evidence that neem oil is also one of these phototoxins. There's some anecdotal stuff online that you can, if you apply it on a hot, sunny day, that it's more likely to burn the plants, which is a perfect example of a phototoxin. So I've had a pond that I was dealing with that the gardener sprayed neem oil in the plants overhead. The first rain, many of the fish died because speculation is, without proof, without an experimental, design to say absolutely or definitively one way or another, the suggestion is that there was enough neem oil buildup on the plants over the pond that when the rain came and washed the residue into the pond, that the fish were not happy.
Well, and the thing is that when people use these products, and I'm one of them, sometimes we think, well, more is better, and that's what we hear in our commercial society, but that's not true. It's one thing, it's already a concentrated product, and, you might be spraying. They have these little teeny tiny, I'm getting old, Bob. It's hard to read these little labels with all this stuff that's not interesting, and I don't really want to read the whole label. So I've used neem oil, and it says use it when the sun's going down or whatever. Okay, I've done that, but maybe I put too much on. The concentration might not have been right. Who knows? So it's a very good point that you have, that just because it's from nature and natural, and just because it says it's OMRI certified, does not mean it's actually good for our water systems and other things. There's not enough laboratory research out there yet to prove that these things are good. So moderation perhaps is good, but if you have water, water, especially in California, I mean, this is episodes heard everywhere, but here we don't have running water. To see a running stream or a creek, we have it certain times of the year, but a pond, if we had a pond, you have manual input of water, and I don't know, beware. And I'm glad you're bringing this issue up, and hopefully people can do more research about that. All right, California Living makes a comment. It says, with ponds, there's rodents that drink from the water too, and it's important since yards are small and they need the water. It's a lot of people, the different elements within the ecosystem need the water, and having these chemical inputs in even, OMRI certified ones might not be good for the creatures. And California Living also has a question. Is there any way to filter the water and use it for garden food plants?
Oh, if you're using it, for food plants, garden food plants. The only, this is a good question too, because there's so many regulations about water use. I don't know of any agency that has categorized a pond as gray water. You're not allowed to use gray water on food plants, but a pond water with just fish, with assuming there's been no animal waste washed into it and stuff, which to me would be the only concern, and it's in my opinion, we've got much more concern of pesticides and pesticide breakdown products than some of the microbiological organisms that people are very concerned about. But that said, I don't feel I can say, oh yeah, no problem with using your pond water on your food plants. Now, pond water on trees or houseplants, I mean, people use their aquarium waters all the time on their houseplants, and their houseplants love it. Using your pond water on non-food crops is probably the smartest thing you could possibly do. But I think it's up to you, the individual, whether they want to use any source of water on their food crops.
All right. Well, so this is a good transition into constructed wetlands, and what you had mentioned was this composting. And on your website, and I'll mention your website is Pura Vida Aquatic.com. So P-U-R-A-V-I-D-A Aquatic, AQUATIC.com. There's a link in the episode details. But on there, you do mention about water composting and gray water systems. You don't like the term gray water, and you can talk about that a little bit. But and Sherry in the chat room says that she'd love to know more about what plants to use to clean water. So I think this is all related kind of to this topic of the
okay.
Wet.
Yep, that's wonderful. I have set up a constructed wetland that takes my laundry water, all the stuff, and aquatic plants, because they pump oxygen to the roots to keep the roots from drowning. A house plant, if you overwater it and roots are submerged, they drown. They suffocate. They don't have enough oxygen. They suffocate. They drown. And then the plant has lost its roots. So no matter what you do, the plant's on its way out because its roots have drowned. Marsh plants and aquatic plants have developed systems to expend a fair amount of energy and pump oxygen to their roots. So the microenvironment right around the root is highly oxygenated, and then as you move away from the root, it becomes has a lack of oxygen, which is known as anaerobic. So you have aerobic is the presence of oxygen right at the root, and anaerobic is the absence of oxygen as you move further away from the root. And then you've got a sunlight impacting on the surface, and all of these environments can break chunks off of chemicals. Some chemicals don't just evaporate. When they say DDT is gone, it's not gone. It breaks down into DDE, which is actually longer-lived and more toxic than DDT. But the companies can say, oh, DDT is gone in, and I don't know how long, DDT is gone in a year. But it is just converted into something that's more toxic that until fairly recently wasn't even studied. And that's the case with many of these other pesticides and things that we're putting out into the environment. We haven't studied, and we don't even know what they're breaking down into. So chemicals don't just evaporate and go poof and are gone. They break down a chunk at a time. These anaerobic, aerobic photolysis systems are exquisitely good at breaking down chemicals all the way. One part of the molecule will break off anaerobically. Another part of the molecule will break off aerobically. Another part of the molecule may break down under UV light more effectively. And so as the water is moving through these wetland environment with all these plant roots and everything, it's going through this incredible sponge that keeps breaking down bits of it. And it's been known for a long time that marsh environments are exquisitely good at detoxifying chemicals. So in addition, soap is about as non-toxic as you can get. It's a carbon, usually nitrogen chain, a chain of carbons with a nitrogen group at one end, which is in reality great plant fertilizer. So I take my soapy water and pass it through a constructed wetland, and when it comes out at the end, it's crystal clear. There are these small aquatic organisms that I use to monitor a lot of things, but they're the water companies, the big water companies, use these organisms to monitor their water discharges. And what they do is they put in these organisms into the water, and if the organisms die slowly enough, they die too fast. If they die slowly enough, the water is good enough to discharge out into our environment. The fact that the organisms I've got are growing and multiplying, I think my water is pretty good. And I take it from there and water my fruit trees. But I love your interest in the term water composting. As you mentioned, I do not like the term gray water. It makes everything sound icky and terrible, and we can compost our kitchen scraps in our backyard. There is no reason that we shouldn't be disallowed in composting our water, our household water, in our backyard. It's not toxic. Now, I'm not talking black water. I'm not talking from the toilets. I'm talking just from your laundry and your shower water. There should be no reason that we can't compost that water in our backyard.
So you can compost it quick enough to use the amount of water that the typical person uses.
Oh yes. It's just a free flow system. The more water goes in at one end, the more water you get out at the other end. And I've got measurements on the system I set up. I kind of did it as a proof of concept. So I was running about 50 gallons a day through it. It could be scaled up. It could be, whatever scale you would like. But I got very interested in California native bog and marsh plants. As I had been saying earlier, we've destroyed so much of our California marshes, and you can't even get the plants that used to grow in them. You can't buy them. You look for California natives, and all you get are the low water use, the xeriscape plants. So I've been trying to get seeds. I've been going to various botanical gardens and stuff. And as I said, I've gotten very interested in California native marsh plants. So I think, from my history, the biological diversity of a system is critical. The more biological diversity you have, the more stable it is, and the long term, the more healthy it is. So with my constructed wetland, which was modeled after what they were doing in Northern California, where they only used two types of plants. They used cattails and bulrushes. And I, as I was saying before that, and Mr. Biodiversity, so I've got at least 50 different species of plants in my constructed wetland that the water flows through. And I'm getting more and more, and I'm finding sources. Every day I Google and look for more native marsh plants to try to get and try to get going in the system too. So I think we have to do a much better job of conserving our water, of putting our water to multiple uses. I've heard a lot of permaculture talks where they point out that if you get two different, that if you use your wastewater to water trees, that you're getting two uses for that water. So in essence, you only pay half for it. Well, I get three uses for mine because I use it in the house. It goes through the constructed wetland, and I get tadpoles, dragonflies. There's an amazing amount of animal life that passes through, checks things out, snakes, king snakes, lots of things, the beneficial insects. It's amazing how often I see butterflies out fluttering around the wetland.
Well, I have so many questions, and I know Sherry does too, and it's like, I don't know, like, it's crazy, but you mentioned, I don't even want to bring up the dragonflies because there's, I don't know much about them, but I want to hear about them. But let's wait about the dragonflies. In California, what are the rules right now about these constructed wetlands? I mean, can you put them in? Do you have to have a permit? What's the status of that right now?
They released a lot of the regulations. California used to be on, or probably still is on, Western standard plumbing codes, and the rest of the country, certainly the East Coast, all went to international standard. And international standard is very good with water reuse. California, for a long time, it was tough to do gray water systems. They have relaxed a lot of that. And one of the primary restrictions now is having a pump installed as part of the system, a permanently installed pump. So if you wanted to, you know, pump water from your bathtub, your shower, out to your landscaping, you could do that because the pump's not permanently installed as part of a gray water system. But if you've got a gray water system that has that requires a pump, then you have to deal with building codes and stuff. But once you get the water to the constructed wetland, the regulations have become dramatically less.
All right. I'm going to just announce the phone number. We have a couple people in the room that might want to call in, but I know Sherry could fill up. We have lots of questions, but I want to give everyone an opportunity. So the phone number, if you have a question to call in, is 347-838-9986. Again, that's 347-838-9986, and you can ask Dr. Lloyd or our friend Bob here any questions you have. But in the meantime, let's have Sherry come on in and ask some questions or make a comment.
Oh, gosh, there's so much. I could think of so many shows here. I guess going back to the pond, I was just thinking, if I end up doing a pond, is there a rule of thumb with how much shade I should give it so that I don't get too much evaporation here in California?
Every pond is different. The more shade you provide, the more you're likely to have leaves and other stuff fall in the pond and collect there. So I don't try to say what a pond should be like. I try to look at an existing pond, how someone has developed it that in an area that they wanted it, and then I try to I work with the owner in setting up ecosystems that are appropriate for that particular pond. So any pond, any place you have it where you can see it conveniently and enjoy it and get to it so you can pull out your lawn chair and sit beside it is a great area for a pond.
If I were to put a big shady tree with lots of leaves falling in a way that might be a good thing, right? Because as they decompose, couldn't I take that out and compost in it? It would be, as I understand it, just so full of nutrients.
Exactly. Each pond is different and unique in its own way. but one type of environment, a big shady tree or complete. I guess the only thing that I would say, just, and it's probably more my personal preference in a pond than otherwise, is not to have it just sitting out in the middle of your yard in bright sunlight, just because I would prefer having a more a more pleasant place for me to sit to enjoy it. But the more trees you have in the neighborhood of the pond, and on a windy day, I mean, leaves stick to water. You know, a gardener blowing leaves along, they'll blow along the grass, and then when they hit the pond, poof, they stay. So you're absolutely right that the leaves decompose. If you can take them out weekly, they make great compost.
But if you had fish, wouldn't they benefit from the leaves being there too as a food source?
It would take a while. The bacteria would start growing on the leaves, and it would take a while for the leaves to decompose enough for the fish to be able to get the nutrients
oh, okay.
value out.
Yeah.
So a lot of leaves at one time is probably too much for the fish to handle
sure.
all at one time anyway. Because usually,
sure.
yes, usually when you have trees, you've got all of a sudden you've got a lot of leaf drop at one time during the year.
All right. Well, we have a caller from area code 425. Are you on the line? You have a question for Bob?
Oh, I'm sorry. Am I online?
You're online.
Excellent.
What's your name?
Yes. My question is, I've got like three or four about, am I actually on the show right now?
You're on the show. I have a question.
Okay, I'm sorry.
We don't have much time.
Okay, yeah, let me hurry up here. I have this mental image of a pond in my backyard with a bench and a tree and all that, you know, the whole koi pond thing, but I want it to be functional as well. What's a good fish which could provide some productivity in, like, the South Seattle area? It drops below 50 degrees, so tilapia, I don't believe, is an option.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. Tilapia are much more of a warm water fish and would not do well at all in Seattle. Any of your carp, your goldfish, your koi, they're two different species of koi. One is all black, and the other one is the patterned koi that more people are, I think, familiar with. But either would do fine.
Excellent. Am I still online?
You were on mute for a while because we were having some feedback. So go ahead if you have another comment or question.
Yeah, I was wondering if any of those fish would serve a little bit of the same function as a chicken to capture some of these productivity out of the kitchen, like kitchen scraps, and turn it into fish. Is there
That's
any
a great
possibility
question.
Of that?
I love that.
I love it too. It's something I thought about. I've never eaten a koi. They're reported to be very bony. So I think with any of the fish that you could get, there are going to be properties to that fish as to why it's not a commercially farmed fish. But if you can put up with those disadvantages, most fish would provide some sort of nutrient. I mean, it's in general, except the famous puffer fish, most fish aren't toxic, and would provide a fine meal.
Excellent. And carp would be able to function as that in that niche.
Yes, and probably certain types of catfish, you probably would want to stay away from non-native and particularly non-U.S. native catfish, but check with your extension or your farm extension. Some states are fussy about importing fish. So you could go around and look on, say, Craigslist or something, and see if you could find somebody in your area that's got a stock and could give you some, or you could go on the internet and try to get some different types of catfish, koi. They're generally not a problem with importing koi because they're so ubiquitous. But some of the species of catfish, I know that the states are concerned about them being released in the wild, and you need some a permit to import them.
Okay, good enough. Last question: have you ever heard of anybody suspending a small LED light like a couple inches above their pond and attracting insects to drop into their pond?
Yes, I've heard of people doing the bug zappers over their pond too. Praying mantis fly, bees, the queens fly to mate. I'm hesitant to say that that's the greatest idea in the world, because you don't have any control over what insects are getting zapped and falling in the pond. And like, for example, the praying mantis, they fly at night and move from place to place. So it'd be difficult even to say, well, I'm only going to do it at night, and that way I'm not killing queen bees, because you've got a variety of beneficial insects that do that too. But if you've got koi or you've got catfish, you don't need to put that effort into catching insects per se. A lot of non-meat table scraps, any kind of your vegetable table scraps, those fish would do fine with.
Excellent. Could I possibly ask one more question? How finicky are a lot of fish that are traditionally vegetarian, like tilapia, for example? How finicky are they on their diet? Will they eat anything but meat? I mean, plants. Sorry.
That's a complex question, and the short answer is many fish are omnivores, and if they're low on food and low on nutrients, they'll eat a variety of things. So that's about the only thing I can say in a short period of time on that.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, caller from area code 425, for your questions. We only have less than a minute left, but one last question from the room. California Living is asking if in these ponds you could build a pond with crawfish, shrimp, and lobster. So, like, those types of creatures in the pond as well.
Short answer again is yes. Some of those organisms are more territorial than fish, and are harder to grow to a density. Those organisms are generally more along the lines of a food organism rather than a pretty organism swimming around to enjoy in my pond. So I assume that the idea behind it is a food organism. And in some cases, organisms like that are fairly hard to grow to a high density in a pond because they're territorial.
Great.
But it's...
Go ahead.
But it's certainly possible to do. I mean, I didn't want to discount being able to do it. It's just that it may not give you the results that you want.
Yeah, and I would think that space would be a major issue because are larger and they eat a lot, and you know, you could certainly do it because it's done in nature. Anything that's done in nature, you could probably do. You know, it's just going to take more time. Well, I really wanted to thank you for joining us, and you are invited back anytime. Anytime. Sherry would
thank
be
you very
thrilled.
Much.
I would be thrilled. We have so many. I mean, we. My gosh. I mean, we didn't have a time to ask you your favorite books on the topic or blah, 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 blah. So, Bob, you have to come back. All right?
I'd be happy to. give me a call, and we'll figure out another time.
All right. So, everyone, if you could visit his website, it's Pura Vida Aquatic, P-U-R-A-V-I-D-A, Aquatic, AQUATIC.com. He has a blog and pictures and lots of good information about the service he provides to the community to go out and help people with their existing ponds. And do you also construct ponds for people, or is it more maintenance and helping to fix existing ponds?
I don't build them. I'm a microbiologist. I don't build them, but I consult on setting up ponds for builders, and I do a lot of work trying to fix problems that have been built into a pond.
All right, great. All right, well, thanks so much, and Sherry, you and everyone else who called in and asked your questions in the chat room. It was a great episode. If hope to talk to you another time and listen to our other episodes. And if you go to asktallpaul.com or permaculturecentral.com, you can see the other episodes and information that I provide on my websites. Thanks so much. Talk to you next
Wonderful.
Time.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Paul.
All right. Bye.